This is Speaking Out on ABC Radio, Radio National, Radio Australia on podcast and the ABC Listen app. I'm Larissa Berendt, and if you like what you're hearing, why not rate us on your app, and that way other people can find us and hear our stories as well. Voicing truth and telling First Nations stories of intersectionality are at the heart of the latest collection of poetry from Mananjali Yugambeh poet Ellen Van Nieuwen. Released in March, Throat explores the themes of our collective history, unconscious bias, and cultural supremacy, while at the same time speaking of vulnerability, love, and language. Ellen Van Nieuwen recently sat down with playwright Nakia Louie to discuss the legacy of colonization, gender, and representation in these complex times.
What I would like to start with is, congratulations. How does it feel having your second collection out of war poems and essays?
It's really good because it's sort of been the last 4 years of work. So, and actually with this work, you know, I always kind of want to strive to be better, you know, and I also see my work as being interconnected, which I see with your work as well. Like, I really love following your body of work as well. And with this particular piece, I went like really perfectionist actually. Like, I just wanted to find the sharpest words that I could find like in each work and really work really hard, like right through the editing process. And I had a really great team as well behind me, but I just really approached it as if, you know, if this is my last book, what do I want to say? And I really didn't want to hold back and just like go for it and really speak truth.
That's so interesting though that you talk about like it being your last book, because I think you've been really successful in that each word does punctuate. And the thing that I find so interesting is that it all interrelates, but there is kind of this continuation of going back to things. There's a repetitiveness that is new and insightful. With Throat, what was the very essence of its inception?
Yeah, there's a line in a poem called "The Body Labours Under Memory." I wrote, "My tongue hurts from the things I have said and the things I haven't." And so that was something that was really kind of just eating at me, like thinking about, you know, had that beautiful quote from Patience Agbibi at the beginning of the book about the throat. I was just really was thinking about just my own journey as someone who grew up, you know, I grew up in Southeast Queensland in the northern suburbs of Mianjin. And I grew up being very quiet and very sort of kind of socialized through non-Indigenous peers to be quiet, to be silent, to not be heard. And I really had a hard time when I was a young person, and then to sort of come to where I am now, to feel as if my words matter and to collectively our words matter as Blackfellas, is something that I really wanted to go deep in. So there's like many beginnings and many endings in the work, but I guess the central theme is about voice and about truth.
That's really interesting that you say that, because the many beginnings and many endings, which is what I want to ask you about next, is I feel like as Aboriginal Torres Strait Islander people, it feels like we have many beginnings and many endings all the time. And you said that you kind of wrote this as if it was your last book. Where does that come from?
That's really interesting, Nakia, and I will share a bit of a personal moment about that, because about 2 years ago I was really in kind of a deep depression. I had moved from Queensland and I lived 2 years in Naam in Melbourne. You know, I had beautiful friends and, you know, very well looked after, but there was something about being off country and being in an industry that I felt was an exploitative industry, you know, that there wasn't enough spaces for us as Blackfellas in our respective arts industries, that there was only certain stories that the mainstream wanted to see from us, whether they be stories about trauma or, you know, stories where we are victims. And it was really something that sort of started to get to me, and I didn't really realize until it was kind of too late and I was in that really dark space.
But I love that about your book. You talk about mental health and you speak about it with such frankness and inclusiveness. I know Aboriginal youth suicide rates are the highest in the world. Well, Aboriginal youth suicides are highest suicide rates in the world. I lost 3 family members to suicide in 1 week a couple of years ago. And I speak publicly about this idea of, you know, I struggle with suicide pretty much on a daily basis. Mm. And people get really scared by that.
Yeah, right.
They're like, yeah. Oh, there's something wrong with you. But when I spoke to my parents about it, I realized, hey, this is something that I actually struggle with every day as well. So I thought that idea of your last book, this sense of, I guess, doom, but maybe that sense of doom is just kind of course we're going to have a sense of doom if we're having to exist in a country that still doesn't recognize us. You speak about the commodification, I guess, of trauma, and you speak about your grandmother in a way that really related to me. I'd love for you to read the poem Vinegar, if that's okay.
Yeah, of course.
And then if you could tell me about your grandmother.
Sometimes the house is unclean. In this panic, I find myself between past and future. When we clean our houses, we do so knowing that they are watching and our lives depend on it. When we teach our children how to clean houses, we do so knowing that they are watching and our lives depend on it. I honor your cleaning recipes, squatting on the shower floor. I will not have to work as hard, and I do not have your burdens, but I wonder, does the intergenerational load get lighter or heavier?
That is so beautiful. I'd love for you to read, when talking about whiteness is approaching in the present climate that we're in, with deaths in custody being, you know, something where people who may not have ever been exposed to these conversations are actually saying this is wrong. I'd love for you to read the poem, A Woman Is Still Not Being Heard.
Yeah, of course. Thanks. I will say it's not enough to say that you're not racist if you're not actively anti-racist. In my opinion, you are racist. We were talking earlier about, you know, that study that's come out that says 75% of non-Indigenous people have unconscious bias against us.
Yeah.
Does that surprise you, sis, or does it surprise me?
No, I did my own study that day. I asked 10 Aboriginal people and 5 non-Aboriginal people, and 100% of people were not surprised.
Yeah.
So that's from the Bureau of Nikkei Statistics.
And that's a study that's 10 years of data, so it's a very comprehensive study. And so, you know, what I kind of think, you know, if you are that 75% that, you know, look at a black or brown face and have that unconscious reaction, those kind of things, what we call microaggressions, you know, like crossing the street when you see a black person, or that, you know, those kind of things, those little things then add up into those big things. And then you have a policeman with his foot on the neck of a black person for however many minutes it was, 8 minutes, and nobody stopping him. I say to those 75%, if you had a tumor on your head, or if you had a, you know, if you had a lump on your back, you would get it checked out. You know, if you know that you have that, you know, those thoughts, educate yourself and make sure that you're not those people that just stand by and watch something like that happen.
And it starts at a really early age, and I'll let you find that, because I think this will relate to it. I was trying to think about that idea of, like, you can have bias and it's uncomfortable, but you can grow and change and you need to engage. And I thought about one of my first relationships that I had, which was with this kind of middle-class white boy from the eastern suburbs of Sydney. And I was in my third year of uni, and it was an abusive relationship. And then one night he bashed me really badly, and the neighbors called the police while his parents were out of town. And I was standing there on the side of the pavement, and he had split my lip, and I was bloody and very bruised. And I was begging the police to not press charges. And I remember thinking to myself that I deserved it, because in my head, I just remember those words so clearly: you stupid Aboriginal girl, like, you stupid Aboriginal girl, how could you let yourself do this? I thought you were better than this. And that's when I realized, like, my mum's a survivor of domestic violence. She runs a community organization that is focused on working with women from domestic violence. I've been brought up by women who have been in this exact same situation. I didn't realize, oh my God, I look down on them. You know, I blame them for their abuse. And I realized in that moment, oh my goodness, I have discriminated against them. Had it not been for that, I don't know if I would have ever had been able to even see that in myself. So I think, you know, that idea of bias, if you're a white fella or anyone and you think, oh, maybe I have these views about Aboriginal people, or maybe I don't because I do this, they're in all of us, right? And sometimes you judge yourself the way other people judge you. Change it. If you don't act
really
on
powerful,
it.
Sis.
But anyway, yeah. I just wanted to bring that up because I think with the poem that you're about to read next, it's so pertinent and important, and it really it gave me a great sense of comfort all being seen. So thank you, Ellen.
That's all right. Yeah, this is a short poem with a kind of a long lead-in because I really wanted to read this poem tonight with what's going on. I've been feeling kind of this tension. Rest in power, Mr. Floyd, you know, it's such an awful thing to lose a brother. But I really feel like, you know, our sisters are still not getting heard. Like, why a black man's death or a white woman's death has more profile and more outrage, public outrage, than a black woman or a black gender diverse person losing their life? Why are their lives seen to be less important? It's really, really hard to think about that. And so, you know, there's this kind of movement towards like, say her name, say their names. So I did just want to say a few names. This poem was originally written for Miss Du, but there's so many names that are just not on people's lips. So I wanted to say Aunty Tanya Day's name. I wanted to say Miss Clark's name, Yamaji woman who was shot by a police officer last year in a Geraldton street. She was 29. I'm 29. I turned 30 this year. She doesn't get to turn 30. I wanted to acknowledge Breonna Taylor in America, as well as Tony McDade, a black trans man who was shot by police 2 weeks ago, and Chantelle Moore, who is a First Nations Canadian woman who was shot by police. So it's so important to say their names.
Thank you.
Women are still not being heard. Women are still not being heard. Our bodies ignored. Crimes against us approved. Sister spoke up. It took her life. In custody, without custodianship, children taken and land weeping and lonely. No more women unheard behind the wall. No more women dead over unpaid fines. No more women dead by men. It must end.
That is incredibly moving. And the unpaid fines for Miss Du. You think about someone like Darren Hinch, who had unpaid court fines, and he went into, you know, he refused to pay it and he was incarcerated and he walked out alive. And then you think about Miss Du, who was incarcerated for an unpaid fine and died on her knees. Why do you think, and you speak about this throughout your book, and I think it's really important because Aboriginal women are the fastest growing incarceration rates, more so than Aboriginal men. Why do you think women kind of have their struggle and their fight? Aboriginal women have their struggle and their fight, someone heard.
Yeah, I wish I knew the answer, sis. I can only say that some of these killings did take place in a kind of a domestic setting in people's homes and less, maybe less on the streets, less opportunity for it to be filmed and to go viral and to have that evidence and to have that pass along. I just really see that the default of black sometimes is men, you know, like we see Black Lives Matter and we see Black Men Matter and we see white and we automatically assume white is women. Like they're kind of like the two default, I feel, in our society. I really just have to talk about living in a patriarchy instead of a matriarchy and the fact that, you know, we live in a world that's very capitalist. You know, it doesn't value women's work, and women's work is closest to the sort of work that sustains our environment and sustains our waterways and sustains our land. And land is a commodity in the society that we live in, and water is a commodity. So I do make that link.
I'd love for you to read this poem. White excellence.
This is kind of a poem that could just keep going. You know, it's it's kind of like It's an answer to what people might ask, like, what can I do as a white person? And it's never ending. I could keep adding to it. It's called white excellence. When it comes to having white people in my life, I choose the cream of the crop. Not your average woke bloke. I'm talking about white excellence. White people at the top of their game. You know the ones you meet and you're like, who's trained you? If you're a white fella in my life, you've gone through a very rigorous selection process. Congrats. And to be H, I'm still testing you, babe. White excellence comes in many forms, but my favorites are the ones that cook for me. Listen, make space, buy black books, buy black music, never assume to know what we think or what we want. Have the difficult conversations, pick up the slack, share the physical and emotional labor. White excellence acknowledges other ways of being. White excellence should be a filter on Tinder. White excellence makes good guests because they know they are permanent visitors.
I love that so much. Like, in a club. I love that line, who trained you? It should be a filter on Tinder.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Can I just ask why and how did that come about? Because I feel like that white excellence, and I think, you know, this idea of people who are marginalized by white supremacy, how much we actually need white excellence to change things at a global level. But also as a black fella, I don't know about you, but you kind of have to be extraordinary just to be accepted. There's no failing upwards as a black fella.
100%. Like, yeah. You know, like, that's, you know, where the term black excellence comes from. Like, when we're like, if, you know, if we're like a deadly footy player, or we're like super smart or whatever, we're black excellence. But, you know, like, it's like cherry picking. But I think we're all excellent. I think all black fellas are excellent. I just want to say, like, we're 2-3% of the population, and what we manage to do on a daily basis is just outstanding. You know, to be able to get the Indigenous Lives Matter rallies happening in like such a short amount of time, sort of like, we've been fighting these battles for so long, and we had that high profile case with Mr. Floyd, and we managed to get tens of thousands of people, you know, us as black fellas with the support of white allies, made that happen. And it was, I think, a really deadly and really hopeful moment for us. And so, yeah, like, we definitely, yeah, we need our white allies. But it's such a, like I say in my poem, you know, it's hard, I think. Nothing comes easy, you know. We know how racist Australia is from the moment we are born. But if you don't experience that racism on a daily basis, it takes a long time to be able to sort of navigate and to understand how to also be part of an anti-racist movement. And so I think we're constantly asked by well-meaning people, I think, you know, what can we do to help? What can we do? And it does put the onus back on us.
Totally.
So we've been saying it for so long, this is what you do, this is what you do. And, so that's kind of an answer to that question, like, what can we do? Yeah.
I also don't think, well, I'd love to cook for you. I love it when white people cook.
I know. I was just thinking, I was like, oh, I really feel like some pasta. Who can I call?
I can't cook pasta for the life of me. But also black fella and islander, and I got a Chinese grandfather who can't cook rice. So I don't know. I would have been kicked out of every village. But I think there's something interesting though. Like, I think you're far more wise and empathetic maybe than me. Because I was thinking about this today, and it's like, oh, you know, like the guy, like, help me learn. And I think sometimes we have to really dumb these conversations down and have to handhold. And that's like, that's labor. And that's kind of diminishing. And I don't know about you, but one of the poems I want to talk about next, I can't wait to meet my future genders. You know, for myself, when it came to refugees, when it comes to, you know, queer community, trans community, like anyone who's different, I don't want people to talk down to me and hold my hand and tell me what to do. You know, you get out there, you research, you actively engage and use your brain, and you do that labor. I mean, I work in theater. you know, that is a majority white people and older white people. It's that thing about who exactly are you writing for, in a way, especially when you write a poem like White Excellence. Mm. And does that take labor for you to then have to go, oh, I'm going to explain to you actually how to be good to me, because I'm good to you, but you've never had to explain to me how to treat you like a person.
That's so true, Nikki. That's a really good point. And I think, yeah, people kind of ask you as the Black creative, who's your audience? Who do you write for? And it's kind of a really hard question, because one, they assume that Black people aren't going to come see your show, aren't going to read your book, which is like, no, like we need to make sure that our work is accessible and we have a really kind of deadly audience. So our audience is not necessarily just white people. It can be both at the same time, and it can be people who don't identify as white or Aboriginal as well, like our migrant communities as well. But I'll always say, you know, in terms of like you saying that you have to dumb down your work, there is like this like racial illiteracy in our country. And I always say that like we were really deadly and smart, and then like the white fellas came here and they were so behind on science, environment, culture, society. They were just like hundreds of years behind, and they're the ones that are like have to catch up and be like, oh yeah, you know, like I read Dark Emu, oh wow, you know, like we had so much stuff before colonization. And so I kind of think, you know, it's you guys that have to come over and understand what we're going through. We don't always have to go over to you. And hopefully, you know, we can continue to have more mature conversations about race. I think that's so essential, especially right now.
Totally. And I think it's a, you know, it's engaging. And I mean, maybe holding yourself to, you know, it's one thing to go, I want to learn, but don't expect someone to necessarily always teach you, because the resources are all there. So, you know, it's that, what's that saying? The path to hell is paved with good intentions. You know, act. I wanted to also then talk about I Can't Wait to Meet My Future Genders and the pieces and poems that are in that part of the book. It's really interesting. I related to it in, I don't want to say eye-opening, but it's an experience where I think, you know, I look at us and I go, oh, there's a lot of things that are really similar. And I read that, I go, there's things that are comparable but not similar at all. Mm. You speak of finding a solidarity in the queer community, and there's a great poem where you talk about being schooled by an Aboriginal couple, Aboriginal lesbian couple at a Mardi Gras, who scolded you for not knowing your history. Can you speak a little bit about finding that solidarity and solace within the queer community?
Yeah, I think, you know, as a young queer Black fella, I felt quite isolated when I was growing up. You know, I didn't really have any people I could turn to, you know, like I was bullied a lot at school. People would always like say to me, like mistake, they would say, you know, you're a boy. And so I like looked really boyish, and I kind of liked that a lot. I didn't mind. I kind of was like, why do you have to kind of keep pointing it out? Like I'm happy in who I am. But I constantly was getting that kind of negative, I guess, gender policing when I was younger. And so I came out as gay when I was, I'm going to say 16. And, you know, it was hard. I had a lot of hard years with my family, who are like really beautiful now. But, you know, it was a tricky time. I actually decided I have to go away. You know, I have to go away. I have to go into the city, because I grew up kind of on the outskirts of Meanjin, Brisbane. I have to go into the city and try and find some solidarity. And that's when I started to learn a little bit more. You know, I had that ignorance as a young person, because it wasn't, I didn't have that representation on TV or whatever. Like, I didn't see people like me. And so then I slowly started to become more engaged and see how many like beautiful LGBTIQ brother, boy, sister, girls that we have in our community, and particularly in the arts as well, because that's the industry that I work in. I was like, oh, beautiful. Like, I feel so connected. And I read Lisa Blair. She's a beautiful poet from Melbourne who passed away. Beautiful work. And I thought, wow, there are people like me. And that was really important to me. I now have come back to where I grew up, which is actually a really great step as well. I've I'm living now in the house that I grew up in, and I'm sort of facing that time where I felt a lot of internalized kind of shame, I guess, into who I was, and feeling, yeah, very kind of grounded and really, really just proud of being part of the queer community. And yeah, I just feel really strong where I am now, which I couldn't imagine when I was like a young person. And like, I'll just to mention, you know, we had beautiful sister Shari Sevens, who had like an on-screen queer kiss on The Heights the other night. I texted her about it. I was like, I haven't seen that. I've been waiting 30 years to see a black queer kiss on screen. Like, why 2020? Why do we have to, like, yeah. I was like jumping up and down, and my parents didn't really get it until I explained to them like how it was so groundbreaking for me, you know?
Oh, totally. Well, we don't really get to see a lot of representations of just, well, number one, black on black love.
Yeah.
Then, you know, then looking at the intersectionality of that, we don't see a lot of that representation, especially within like First Nations mob, of just how important the queer community has been. You have a poem called Bonsoi, and I've put it here because this bit just really spoke to me. It says, sometimes I just want to know this body can be enjoyed by someone, not necessarily myself. You speak a lot about colonization and colonized sexual identities. I thought that idea of colonized bodies and how that you talk about, you know, I can't wait to meet my future genders. For me, you know, it was this idea of to actually feel like I ever had control over my body. I had to conform. When you sit in your house, do you ever think about, you know, Ellen when you did feel ashamed?
Yeah, I kind of get those feelings of shame every now and again. And what I do, I light a candle. You know, what's best is smoking, right? Like that's really beautiful. But if I can't smoke the house, I'll just light a candle and I'll just let the smoke come up, and I'll just tell myself that I'm like doing the best that I can, and I am the best that I am. And it kind of sounds a bit corny, but it actually really helps. And I was taught that by an auntie of mine. So we have to keep doing that. And I think Nayuka Gori has some really beautiful writing around gender and colonization that people should check out. And I remember them saying, tweeting one time, my gender didn't come on a boat. And I think, you know, that's really, we can really think about what are those enforced ideas about who we are that have come from somewhere else and are not actually come from our culture.
I wanted you to, if you could, read the poem Sand, and then I had one question. I'll leave it to one. Yeah.
We sat up singing, covering our feet from the cold. The sand I carry in my heart is hot. The shadows are wet. My heritage is to honour those that are in my blood. We will not tire now. This song will keep going in us.
I love that. Thank you for those words. I love how you put the song being the fight and the fight being actually a gift that you're privileged to be able to sing, I guess.
Absolutely, yeah.
But I just have this one question. As we're seeing these statues of Cook and colonial invaders being pulled down around the world, and I think, I don't know if it's still there, but the replica HMAS Endeavour, I think it was still sitting in Sydney Harbour at some point over the last kind of week. If we were going to pull down all those statues, would you want to see another statue put up? And who would you put that statue up of? Or what would you put a statue up of for Australia to look at?
Oh, that's beautiful. The first person I thought of was Ujuru Noonuccal, Ani Ujuru, who's a beautiful writer, first female Aboriginal writer publishing in the 60s, and just deadly on so many counts, from Manjiraba, Stradbroke Island. But I actually had an idea for a statue, and my beautiful friend gave me this postcard that I just like have on my thing, and it says, X is for the women whose names we don't know. And I really think that just to choose one person would just be so hard, because there's so, you know, many of our ancestors whose stories remain untold.
Well, Ellen, I'm so happy I got to speak to you, and thank you
That's okay. It's been a pleasure. Thank you so much.
You've been listening to poet Ellen van Nieuwen discussing their latest collection of works, Throat, with playwright Nakia Louie. The conversation was part of the Wednesday Night Book Club podcast series hosted by Tracy Spicer.